This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we're going to have Scott Creighton, and we're going to be talking about a very important book filled with new discoveries, The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. We now know that it's there. We know this. But what does it mean? And what does it have to do with our era and beyond? Because it turns out maybe a great deal, and it's important to understand this. Scott Creighton is an engineer. He has traveled many ancient sacred sites. He's been on Ancient Aliens, Coast to Coast. He's the host of an alternative Egyptology forum on Above Top Secret. And he has been on Dreamland a number of times, I believe. He is the author also of The Great Pyramid Hoax. Scott, welcome to Dreamland.
Hi, Whitley. It's very good to be here. Pleased to meet you again.
Yes, it is good. And this book is explosive. I have got pages and pages of notes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I read. As my listeners know, I think I'm one of the few hosts who actually reads books that they interview people about, because most of them do a good job. But it's not this type of job.
Yeah.
All right. Now, let's start by talking about the scan team and its findings and what it was and what they were doing, if you can explain that to us.
Okay, well, quickly, in November, I think it was November 2017, a group of around 30 scientists from all over the world published their research in the famous journal Nature. I'm sure you're probably quite familiar with that particular journal. Now, after 2 years of studying the Great Pyramid using a scientific technique known as muon tomography, it's kind of like taking an X-ray of the Great Pyramid and or the Great Pyramid's interior, I should say. The Scan Pyramids team announced the discovery of a massive, hitherto unknown space, or void, as they call it, deep inside the Great Pyramid. Now, just to let you understand, or your viewers and listeners understand, Whitley, this space that they've discovered is as big as the Grand Gallery, which is about, 100 foot long, 30 foot wide, 30 foot high, I should say. And the Grand Gallery sits about 15 feet below this void space. So we can imagine the Grand Gallery goes through the pyramid at a sort of 26 degree angle, maybe something like that. I'm showing with my pen here. And the big void. Now, they don't know if the big void is at a similar angle. The big void sits above it like that, okay? So they're not sure if the big void is angled like the Grand Gallery or if it is, in fact, level like that. I'm just showing here with my two pens. So anyway, now, Egyptology is, when it was discovered, Egyptologists were kind of reluctant to speak about it because, essentially, they don't know what this space is. They don't consider it likely to be a chamber because there's no passage, or the Scan Pyramids team did not detect any passages to or from this void, this space. So it seems to be entirely cut off from the rest of the pyramid structures inside the pyramid. Some people believe that the space may not actually exist, that it's just an error, a data error in the scan pyramid's data, that it may have been receiving a ghost image, if you like, of the Grand Gallery itself, a sort of reflection image that their data somehow managed to pick up. And so to eliminate that possibility that what they were seeing was some kind of reflection or ghost image, the Scan Pyramid team undertook a new series of scans in 2019. And in those new scans, they were able to truly confirm the presence of this big void. It's real. It's big, and it's there.
So we now know that it's there. And over the course of this show, folks, we're going to be talking about what it is and why it's there. But we are also going to be talking about something that is intimately connected with it, which is, we will call it pole shift, but it is much more complex than that. There is something about planet Earth that they experienced and to a great degree understood and left us information about not only what it was and what happened, but also about when it would happen again. And in the third half hour, we'll get into that latter part. Now, I want to go back to the Coptic texts that you reference in your book that do discuss the various things that, well, no, before that, let's go back to the Grand Gallery and talk about what may have been in the Grand Gallery in the days that of the pharaohs, and where those, what remains of those objects may be now. I think it's a very interesting story.
Yeah, well, the Grand Gallery is a very peculiar chamber within the Great Pyramid. There's nothing else like the Grand Gallery in any other pyramid. I mean, it's absolutely ginormous. It's huge. Absolutely huge. As I said, it's about 100 feet long and about 13 feet high, about 10, 15 feet wide, something like that. And as I said, Egyptologists, they really don't know why the Grand Gallery is there. It's just some ceremonial procession way for the king, you know, leading up to the final chamber at the top of the Grand Gallery, which is the king's burial chamber, which connects to the Grand Gallery via a small antechamber. So that's the alternative view. It's some sort of procession way, grand procession way for the king, which in a whole number of ways really, really doesn't make any sense. But along each side of the Grand Gallery, there are what are called the pavements or the sidewalks for an American audience. And these pavements, sidewalks, have, each one is about probably about 2 feet wide. And they go either side of the Grand Gallery from the bottom all the way to the very top of the Grand Gallery. And inside, cut into these pavements, are what are called the notches. And these notches are about 2.5 to 3 feet wide. They're about 8 to 10 inches deep and about 6 to 8 inches depth. So Egyptology, again, they don't know what the purpose of these notches are. There's 27 of them. There's 27 of these notches on either side of the Grand Gallery. That makes a total of 54 of them altogether. And as I said, Egyptology has no idea what these are. Now, there was, I think it was a physicist, a guy called André Pochan. And back in the 1970s, he came up with a theory for what these 54 notches actually were. And this theory is linked to some of the Coptic Egyptian texts that have come down to us that were translated in early medieval times by some Arabic scholars such as Al-Masudi, Al-Makrizi and so forth and so on. Various Arabic scholars translated these Coptic texts or oral traditions, actually. And what they said was that when the early explorers, like Al-Mamun, blasted his way into the pyramid in medieval times, I think it was about 800, something like that, AD, something like that, he discovered statues within the Grand Gallery on either side, all the way to the top. And what I suspect and what Pochan suspected was that these notches were basically slots into which these 54 statues of Khufu's ancestors were situated. This is how they were fixed into this pavement so that they wouldn't slide or move.
Yes.
Because remember, it's angled at 26.5 degrees. So they would need these notches on these pavements. There was also grooves cut into the wall a couple of feet up each above each of these notches so that there was obviously some fixing mechanism on the actual statue itself. Some kind of boss which would be embedded into the wall again to keep the statue secure. So this is what André Pochan thought these notches and grooves were for. And as I said, it is backed up by some of these ancient Coptic Egyptian texts that say there were statues of Khufu's ancestors within this chamber.
So these texts should be respected, but they're considered fanciful, folks, by the Egyptologists. We're going to get into the texts because we have reason to believe just from this that the texts are accurate. These texts, it's a Coptic Egyptian oral tradition that tells us the stars wandered confusedly from their courses. So you say in chapter 3 of your book, Wandering Stars. All right. What happened? Well, rather than making it too open-ended like this, let's talk about the various different types of pole shift. Now, we're not talking here, folks, about magnetic pole shift, which is very definitely a known phenomenon and seems to be setting up to happen at the present time, although how long from now, we don't know. This is other types of pole shift. And let me read you a few quotes. This is from Isaiah 24. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty and maketh it waste and turneth it upside down. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and it shall fall and not rise again. That's from Isaiah. From Amos 8, and it shall come to pass that in that day, saith the Lord God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in the clear day. Very dramatic statements. Has it happened and will it happen again, Scott?
I believe it has happened. I absolutely, genuinely believe it has happened because, yes, as you read out those particular passages from the Bible, there are many, many other ancient texts from societies and civilizations all over the world that speak of this event occurring in ancient times. You know, whether it's you know, the indigenous populations of Greenland, whether it's the indigenous populations of North America and Canada, whether it's the South America, China, we hear these stories of the earth turning over, of the stars moving out of their normal course, of the sun rising in the west and setting in the east. All these different pole shift phenomena are recorded by our ancient ancestors, and they have been committed to texts. And yeah, I absolutely believe that the monuments at Giza were actually designed partly because of this, but they actually show us the pole shift actually happening and exactly what happened to Giza, that part of the world, during this pole shift event. So yeah, I absolutely do believe that this happened in the past, and it's happened, as you know, Whitley, since you've read the book, it's happened at least twice.
Well, in recent, it must have happened thousands of times over the life of the earth.
Yeah, now, in recent times, you know, in the last processional cycle, I think this event occurs twice within every 26,000 years.
What's interesting about that is that you don't mention it in the book, but there's some strange supporting evidence that there was a cycle, that this happened around 5,000, roughly 5,000 BC. And I say roughly because what I'm going to talk about doesn't have the most specific dating. One thing is this, the Utsi, the Iceman, who was running through a forest glade in the Tyrolean Alps when he died, was killed, fell, and snow began. And it snowed, and it snowed, and it snowed. And the forest glade never thawed out again. It became a glacier instead. Now, at the same approximate time, and I have to say approximate here, Professor Lonnie Thompson, who is a glaciologist, analyzed glaciers in the Andes and found that at the base of these glaciers, which he dated to about the same period, there was quick frozen deciduous plants. In other words, these plants had been frozen so quickly that they were like something you would buy in a grocery store from the freezer. The cells weren't damaged. They were absolutely frozen almost instantaneously. Now, you put those two things together and you see that at that time, something extraordinary was happening on planet Earth. Yeah. And I think you know what it was, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, there's also, I'm sure you're very well aware, Whitley, of the research of Professor Charles Hapgood in the 1940s and 1950s. And, you know, he managed to uncover a ton of evidence, which he presents in his book, Earth's Shifting Crust, and his later book, The Path of the Pole. And honestly, it's just inconceivable to me how science is able to find a way to somehow discredit the an incredible amount of research that Hapgood did. I mean, even Albert Einstein accepted the possibility that, you know, the Earth, could have pole shifts, whether the turnover, whether it's just a crust or whatever. But Einstein himself accepted Hapgood's argument, and I think he even wrote the foreword to Hapgood's book. You know, so it's really just about trying to find the mechanism, what makes this thing happen, because I genuinely do believe, after the research that I've been undertaking for the last, I've been interested in this topic probably for about 20 years, but probably more seriously interested in it in the last 10 years or so. So, yeah, I genuinely do believe that the research of all these different scientists that uncover these incredible anomalies, you know, of woolly mammoths, you know, that have been flash frozen in a part of the world, which, you know, it just shouldn't have happened, you know. Right. You know, so it's like all these different things. There's another, I'm not sure if you're aware of the chap Mark Gaffney. He's produced recently some amazing evidence using, I think, mollusks. That obviously exist in the ocean. And these mollusks are very temperature-sensitive creatures. And he shows how suddenly this particular type of mollusk suddenly moves something like 1,600 or 2,000 miles to a different habitat, you know, with the temperature, you know, was different. But was it different, or was it the pole shift that, you know, yes, actually,
well, if it was an axial shift, if the planet moved, speaking of movement, folks, free Dreamlanders, make the move to subscribe to unknowncountry.com. do it now, for you, we will be right back.
As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to me now from June of 2010, talking to Alan Lammers about an incredible thing that happened to him on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia.
Here you are in South Sulawesi in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. What happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I work with with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow, and, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear.
You will find the rest of that story, and it is brain-bending, in the June 5th edition of Dreamland, June 5, 2010 edition of Dreamland in the unknowncountry.com archive. This archive is one of the richest of its kind in the world, probably is the richest of its kind in the world, filled with extraordinary shows, of which this show is certainly one, this show with Alan Lammers. You will never have heard anything like it. It does what Dreamland is here to do. It opens your mind to the fact that we live inside a hidden reality that we prefer not to acknowledge, but not here. Here on unknowncountry.com, we do acknowledge it. We live in it and we love it. Subscribe today. You can't go wrong. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and get started.
We're talking to Scott Creighton. His new book is quite incredible. The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. Scott has basically cracked the code about pole shift and also come to understand what is likely to be in this void that we now know is there. There's no question about it anymore. It is there. And there are plans being made to explore it, of course. So, Scott, but let's now go back to this remarkable situation. I would like to just mention in passing that Scott has a list in this book of from Emanuel Velikovsky's 1950 book, Worlds in Collision, which was far more important than people gave it credit for at the time. It is a list of all kinds of statements about this, ranging from the Romans to the Eskimos, about statements about this movement of the planet happening. And they're not contemporary with the movement of the planet, but they are memories of something that were passed down from person to person. And disrespecting those memories and that type of information passage is disrespecting mankind and disrespecting the past and trying to impose a belief system on the narrative. And we were just getting into why that might be. And I thought, I don't want to deal with it too much because we're here to inform, not to whine about the failures of science. But the reason I think is summed up beautifully in an all-time classic by Barbara Hand Clow called Catastrophobia, where she offers the theory that we are traumatized because we live on a planet that is particularly prone to sudden and extraordinary overturning of its normally very placid and regular life. And this is supported by Hamlet's Mill, also a great book that everyone should have in their library. But Barbara Hand Clow says that there's a psychological block. People can't handle the truth. And I think that extends to the conventional scientific and Egyptological communities. They don't want to face the reality. How do you respond to that?
Well, I absolutely agree with it. I mean, I think partly as well, Whitley, it's you know, to do with, there's this atmosphere built up within the scientific community that to believe in such radical, I put that in quotes, radical or scare quotes, radical ideas, you could end up being, the butt of all the jokes and ridiculed. You know, so there's a certain sense of fear there for a lot of people in the scientific community. I've got a great respect for the scientific community, but I think they're hamstrung by their own discipline to a large extent. One of the interesting things which is starting to emerge is starting to change is the science of geomythology. And it was discovered it started to formulate in the 1970s by a geologist called Dorothy Vitaliano. And what she basically argued as a scientist is that a lot of the world's myths and legends most likely have a basis and truth, which relates to, you know, some kind of earth changes, whether it's of a geological nature, an astronomical nature, or even a paleontological nature. She argues that all these strange occurrences in the sky, or even on land, or within geology of the earth, can be accounted for, like a volcano erupting is, you know, described as, you know, some incredible act of the gods, and all manner of ancient myths, you know, the serpent in the sky, the dragon in the sky, you know, is perhaps some comet passing close to the earth, you know. So she realized that all these things could actually, these myths and legends actually contain kernels of truth, kernels of fact. And the way she puts it is that the science of geomythology turns mythology back into history. That's the way she puts it. And it's good to see, because more and more scientists are actually now, it's an emerging science. It's not like totally mainstream, but it has now emerged into mainstream science, the study of these ancient myths to find what actually really happened in the past. And I think that really, really is important. And more scientists are starting. There's reluctance, there's hesitance. But because geomythology has got an ology on the end of it, it becomes scientific. So that's okay. That's permitted. That's allowed. We can study that. So it's allowing scientists to engage in a field where latterly they probably dared not dip their toes.
Well, that's good news for certain, yeah, because the past has a great deal to teach us about the future. Absolutely. And it's time we started trying to seriously find out. And by the way, folks, if you want to try to seriously find out right now, get the Great Pyramid Void Enigma. It is a really a treasure. I think it's the best worked out book on these type of earth changes that's ever been written. And I've read them all. I've read them, every one of them. And I've even read one. It was published in first published in 1954, that is referenced in your book. And I want to talk about it a little bit now. It's called The Adam and Eve Story, folks. And when it was first published, it was classified and withdrawn due to the CIA's intervention, and now was republished in 1993 there will be a link to it online on the show so that you can easily click through to it and read it. But can you tell us a little bit about this book? And if you know, and I personally do not know, what parts of it were classified?
Well, I wish I knew which parts were classified, Whitley, because the parts that weren't classified themselves really raise, you know, your eyebrows. You're like, whoa, what? You know, some of Chan Thomas's ideas are just totally mind-blowing and utterly explosive.
Well, tell us a little bit about Chan Thomas's ideas.
Well, he basically, I think he's very much along similar lines to other catastrophists, you know, who have gone before him, like Ignatius Donnelly and people like that. He believes that mankind has gone through so many, many cycles. I think it is about four or five cycles that he suggests. You know, like Noah and the Ark, and Adam and Eve, Noah and the Ark, Isis and Osiris. You know, all these different icons, you know, ancient icons that we read about in the Bible, and, you know, pyramid lore, and, you know, the pyramid texts of the ancient Egyptians. They were actually different incarnations, are the survivors of these pole shifts events that keep occurring or reoccurring post-shift events. And I think he reckoned that they occur something like every 3,600 years, something of that order. So that's the basis of his general idea, is that these historical figures that we read of are actually different ages of man, across tens of thousands of years. And they were the survivors, if you like, of these cataclysms, or one of the survivors anyway. And the thing about his ideas is he was probably one of the very first that I think came up with some credible mechanism for these pole-shift events to occur. And that is basically by proposing that at the core of the Earth, the core of the Earth explodes, basically, after, I think 3,600 years. And that explosion deep within the core of the Earth, it's like a pulse, a pulse explosion, just boom, nuclear explosion in the core of the Earth. And that explosion essentially heats up the interior core of the Earth, and basically liquefying the interior mantle of the Earth, which to essentially a liquid. And that is what he believes allows the Earth to, or the crust of the Earth, the outer shell of the Earth, to move over the inner core, the inner body of the Earth. And as this liquid cools down it solidifies again and basically it stops the sliding motion of the crust over the Earth. So that essentially is Chan Thomas's theory in a nutshell.
So he had an insight that someone in the intelligence community thought should be hidden. And that says something about it, I think. And it's very disturbing because there are dates in the book, and it suggests that this is not far, that another one of these events is not far off. But before we get into that, Free Dreamlanders, take another break and enjoy yourself. Have a cup of coffee or say the rosary or something, because you'll be waiting for a good long time before we get back.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold, and as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We live right now in a time of great upheaval and personal loneliness and also dread. The dread comes from the fact that we've been taught that we are only material bodies, and therefore we're terrified of death as never before. But it's not true. And in my book, Jesus, A New Vision, I look at this in a completely new way, not through the lens of Christianity and not through the lens of secularism either. By exploring the life of Jesus and his teachings in this new way,
Jesus in New Vision sheds fresh light on the meaning and power of his life, his parables. It explores the mysteries of the Gospels of Thomas and Mary with fresh insight, and it explains why he did what he did, which was to commit suicide by crucifixion. Then it goes into what the Shroud of Turin really is. It is not a medieval forgery. Something extraordinary happened in that tomb. To find out, read Jesus in New Vision. It is truly a first.
It's available on Amazon as a Kindle, as a paperback, and on Audible and Amazon and Apple Books as an audiobook read by me. Get it today.
We're back. We're talking to Scott Creighton. His book, The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. And the book goes beyond that. And we're going to find out, by the way, later, what probably is in that hall. And it's going to be a very surprising part of the show, believe you me, folks. Now, let's go back to what we found in the book we were just discussing. And the interesting thing is that his title is a little strange, and it reminded me a little bit of a book that Linda Moulton Howe looked for years, called Ancient Greek Gods and Their Lore Revisited, that was allegedly pulled by the CIA, and no copies have ever been found. The Adam and Eve story, it's not about Adam and Eve. It's about something entirely different. And yet at the same time, it is a sort of a revisionist creation myth, isn't it?
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's a while ago since I read that book, but yeah, that essentially is my impression of it as well. It's almost like an allegory of the Bible itself. The stories in the Bible. Some people think many of the stories in the Bible are allegorical. Well, this particular work of Chan Thomas, that seems to be an allegory of an allegory. It's really, really well done, and I think it does particularly the mechanism was the thing that fascinated me most, because that was the thing that you always come up against a brick wall with. Well, how could this actually happen? But then Whitley just sort of went off at a tangent here. How can this happen? How can the Earth just go like that? Rapidly.
Let's talk a little bit about the different forms of pole shift, but before we. And then we're going to go down another road. But tell us a little bit about the different forms of what where the Earth would move on its axis or move in some way and reorient itself.
Yeah. Well, you've essentially got three sort of types of pole shift. Now, I think in the past, most people writers, researchers have suggested that there's only two, but there's actually three. And the first one is fairly straightforward. It's one that probably most people will be familiar with, and that is just simply the ball of the Earth, the rotating ball of the Earth, simply turns over 180 degrees in space, Earth, rotational axis, and everything. Now, with that type of pole shift, the Earth turns completely upside down with its rotational axis. Nothing has actually moved anywhere. If we moved, turned over 180 degrees just now, Whitley, the Earth did that right now. Well, the North Pole would become the South Pole would become the North Pole, but they would still be in the polar regions. There would be no difference.
Right.
The latitudes wouldn't change at all, because the latitudes of the Earth only change when the pole of the Earth, you know, changes relative to the Earth's ground mass. Imagine you have a ball of clay and you put like a rod through it, like a long knitting needle. You put it through your ball of clay and you just tip it round. You know, well, nothing changes relative to the pole. So everywhere will have the same climate that it currently has, including the poles. They'll still be in the polar regions. The temperate regions will still be in the temperate zones and so forth and so on. However, if you take your ball of clay and you actually move the needle through the clay, yeah, and that becomes your new rotational axis, then what you have is every part of the Earth has moved to a different geophysical location relative to the pole. So if you move nearer to the pole, then as the pole moves through the clay, it's moving closer to you, then you're actually moving into the polar region. And likewise, if you're moving further away from the pole, then you're moving into warmer latitudes. So that essentially is a kind of simple way of trying to envisage this. Now, the next type of pole shift, that first one was just a straight axial tilt. The Earth and the polar axis turn together. The next type of pole shift is where the axis remains fixed in space relative to the fixed stars. The axis, the rotation, the Earth's rotational axis remains fixed. And what actually happens is that the upper crust of the Earth just basically slides through the axis. But it will do so, it would have to do so to maintain the laws of the conservation of angular momentum. So it'd have to do that in a spiral. Yeah. So that is how the Earth can actually move through. If you imagine the pole is fixed, yeah, the actual rotational axis of the pole. I'm not talking about the North Pole. Imagine this pole extended out into space like a rod, and the Earth, the ball of the Earth, is in the middle. What you've got is the crust of the Earth is actually moving through this pole, which is fixed. And so then what you have is the poles moving to different locations and the temperate zones moving to different locations because, you know, the pole is fixed and they're all moving away from the pole or towards the pole. And in this particular scenario with the Earth sliding over, as Hapgood suggested, the Earth sliding over the inner core, you can get a full 180-degree turn of the Earth using that particular method. Some people call it Earth crust displacement, true polar wander, although it's not actually the pole that wanders, it's the Earth itself that wanders. Scientists say this occurs like, you know, less than half a degree, you know, every million years or so that this shift occurs. But the evidence, as far as I'm concerned, shows that these pole shifts occur as true polar wander occurs much more rapidly. Now, in that second example that I showed, that I told you about there, with the Earth, this ECD, Earth crust displacement, or rapid true polar wander, the pole was fixed, the Earth is sliding through the pole 180 degrees in a spiral. Now, what then happens, and this is a really strange thing, which I write about in the book, because scientists, if you think, you probably know this, Whitley, when you say the Earth, the sun rose in the west and set in the east, most scientists would say, well, that's just dumb, because the only way that can happen is if the Earth stopped still and started rotating the opposite direction, which, you know, according to the laws of, you know, the conservation of angular momentum, that's just never going to happen. And I agree that, and I accept that. But here's the thing. With this particular mechanism, which was actually originated by a guy called, a physicist called Peter Warlow. And what happens then is that with the pole remaining fixed and the Earth sliding basically through the pole up 180 degrees upside down, it actually ends up spinning in the same direction. But because it's now upside down, the sun will then appear to rise in the west and set in the east.
Now, that's an actual principle of physics that he discovered, of mechanical physics. Can you tell us the name of it? As I have it in my notes, but
It's the tippy-top
theory. The tippy-top effect, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now, which of these, well, I will preface this next question just briefly. I'll start with my mother. Back in the 60s, the family has a country house north of San Antonio, which sits on a bluff overlooking a river. And there's a river valley there. It's not a very high bluff, maybe 60 or 70 feet. But it overlooks this valley, a farming valley, very quiet valley. And she believed that she had actually seen this river in such a flood that the flood filled the entire valley. And what was so bizarre about that is that she insisted it had actually happened, but it couldn't have. There would be no farms. The valley would have been stripped of everything. And when I pointed it out to her, she said, well, I'm sorry, it happened. And I think she might have been seeing the future, because she later on, 40 years later, I guess in more recent times, in the late 90s and early 2000s, I began to dream of huge floods, and I began to get letters from other close encounter witnesses who were having the same dreams, and this flood mythology is inside us somewhere. And I want to ask you, which of these different types of shift could cause the oceans to wash out of their beds and sweep across the land?
Well, it would need to be, well, in my opinion, it would need to be, there's a couple of things that could happen. You could have the Earth turning over, and then as the Coptic Egyptian prophecy, it was a prophecy at the time, because the king's priests, astronomer priests, saw that the heavens were moving. And the king asked, what does this mean? And they said, well, it means in 300 years there will be a great flood which will completely destroy, you know, our civilization. It will completely destroy the kingdom and everything in it. So they're saying, they knew that, well, they're seeing this pole shift actually happen. They're watching it happen. So it's happening relatively slowly, we would have to think, if they're watching it happen. But then they're saying in 300 years' time, there'll be a devastating flood which will destroy everything. So that to me suggests that they have had information handed down from their ancestors that knew of these great cycles of the Earth, and that when the Earth does tilt like this, different parts, like the poles, the polar regions, the frozen polar regions, move into warmer latitudes of the Earth. And what you have then, what, like, you know, if you imagine this great ice sheet, the Cordilleran ice sheet, which was over North America, and the other one across Europe, supposedly 12,000 years ago. If you imagine that being subjected suddenly, relatively quickly, to massively increased temperatures, solar radiation, then that goes into a serious rapid meltdown. What you'll have is this massive, this incredible amount of water, lake, sea, whatever you want to call it, building up in the center of this, like a bowl, like a massive bowl, a massive ice bowl, building up in the center of this ice bowl, gradually, slowly melting over this 300 to 500 year period or whatever. Eventually, the pressure within the bowl becomes too great for the rim of the bowl to contain it any longer, and the rim of the bowl suddenly breaks. And what you then have is a torrent, an absolute torrent of water just gushing over the landscape, tearing up everything in sight, you know, ripping mountains apart, you know, throwing 100-ton rocks everywhere. You know, it's just such, it's an unimaginable force we're talking about here. And it's probably, you're probably familiar with the Scablands in the northwest part of the United States, the channeled Scablands, discovered by J. Harlan Bretz. He realized that this ripple effect on the land, I think these ripples, now if you look at a beach, you can see small ripples in the sand. Well, these ripples that Harlan Bretz discovered were about 15 to 20 feet high, these ripples. Yes. You know, so you can imagine the scale of this flood that tore across, you know, Northwest America. Now, here's the thing, though, Whitley. What would happen when you've heard of the Zhannebikov effect, yeah? Have you heard of the Zhannebikov effect?
Yeah, and explain the Zhannebikov effect to us.
Yeah. Zhannebikov was a Russian cosmonaut. And in the 1980s, when he was repairing something, I think in Salyut 7, space station, Russian space station, he was unscrewing this handle from a bolt on the side of a panel within the space station. And what he did, he just gave it a quick dunt with his hand, and it spun off its mounting. It spun right off its mounting and kept on spinning in zero gravity through the length of the space station. But here's the thing. Zhannebikov noticed that every so often, at regular intervals, this handle, it was like a T-shape, you know, it was sort of a T-shape like that. It kept spinning all the way through the station, but suddenly it would flip over like that, and then it would
flip, literally flip.
It flipped 180 degrees with no outside torque or interference whatsoever. It would just do this by its own accord. Now,
just hold on a second. What happened, folks? Just like what happened with the Chan book, the Russians classified this for 10 years, just as this, and maybe even for the same reason that the book was classified. And there's something going on that somebody, I think, would rather we not understand. And we're right there, right now. So go ahead.
Yeah, so the Russian government, as you say, quickly, they classified that discovery by Zhannebikov because they didn't understand it. But the curious thing was the mathematics behind it were actually already known. The mathematics behind the effect had been known since, I think, the early 19th century. And what it turns out is it's now referred to as the, you'll hear it described as the tennis racket theorem or the intermediate axis theorem or the, you know, those kind of terms. And basically, if something isn't designed perfectly, you know, symmetrical, balanced, there's just a slight blemish on one of the axes of, like, this handle, then for whatever reason, when it spins in zero gravity, this imbalance causes this flipping motion. Now, scientists believe that because the Earth is a sphere, it only has one axis. It does not have an intermediary axis or a secondary axis from which there can develop an instability. So this is what they tell us. But then I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. If you have a massive amount of water, you know, unimaginable amount of water, a big bowl of it, and, you know, just think of the central landmass of the United States, you know, probably from, like, the Rockies right over to New York, you know, and take that as a huge big circle, all filling up with water, and then suddenly it breaks. What you then have is a sudden shift of mass. You have a sudden shift of mass going very rapidly from one place to another place on the planet. Now, that's hitting, that all that water is hitting the oceans. So you just simply cannot imagine the tsunamis and worldwide floods that that is going to cause. But I'm thinking also, Whitley, that, well, wait a minute, that is also going to induce a secondary rotational axis, an intermediary axis, with this imbalance. And, you know, because this mass is suddenly going from there to there, you've got an imbalance in the Earth. And if you read the book, there's a chap called, I think he's a Spanish naval engineer, Spanish naval engineer, maybe it's Italian, but I think Spanish naval engineer, who developed this pole shift theory, whereby a massive amount of water, you know, suddenly shifting on the Earth can induce a pole shift in practically a day. You know, he shows the mathematics of it. You know, when you have a massive amount of water like that, and you know, I mean, we just cannot envisage, you know, the amount of massive water that this would have been. But he shows how this massive water, Flavio Barbiero, that's his name, he shows how this mass amount of water shifting from one place to another can induce an instability in the Earth, which then can escalate into a full tilting of the Earth of 180 degrees. And he says it could occur in less than a day. Now, we see all this evidence about, you know, creatures' habitats instantly changing from temperate to frozen, frozen to temperate, almost instantaneously. Then, you know, this, you know, Zhelyabikov effect could actually happen to the Earth, despite the reassurances of, you know, science that it can't.
Yeah, it seems clear that it happened during the time of Utsi the Iceman.
Yeah.
It happened, in fact, during the time of the Old Kingdom in Egypt.
Absolutely. And I do go into that in the book. That
there was, I know you do. It's great in that sense.
There was a pole shift probably about 4,500 to 5,000 years ago.
Well, free Dreamlanders, we have to say goodbye to you now. And in the next half hour, we're going to be talking about the when and the not. We've been talking about the why. We're going to be talking about the when. Does this mean anything to us now? And what is in that void? Because Scott's got some very specific and very well worked out ideas about what we may find there and the extraordinary meaning it might have for us. Scott Peyton's book is The Great Pyramid Void Enigma, The Mystery of the Hall of the Ancestors. He is also the author of The Great Pyramid Hoax and was on William Henry's show, Revelations. I mentioned Scott had been on Dreamland earlier. That's not correct. He was on Revelations. Yeah. And in a two-week show with William Henry back, I believe, in 2012. So it's been a long time, but it's also a wonderful show. So if you'd like to get more deeply into the pyramid hoax and the mystery of the Giza Plateau, continue listening today and get into Scott's previous shows on unknowncountry.com by simply searching on the word Creighton, C-R-E-I-G-H-T-O-N. Free Dreamlanders, thank you as always for being with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.